Have you called Lena? No, I can...
Good. Do you want me to?
No. A silence fell between them. The kind of silence particular to hospitals, which stems from the fact that the very situation, one person in the bed, sick or injured, and a healthy person at her side, says it all. Words become small, superfluous. Only the most important ones can be said. They looked at each other for a long time, said what could be said without words. Then Virginia turned her head in line with her body, stared at the ceiling.
You have to help me.
I'll do anything.
Virginia licked her lips, breathed in, and let out the air with a sigh so deep and long that it seemed to draw on hidden reserves of air in her body. Then she let her gaze slide up Laka's body, searching, as if she was taking a last goodbye of the body of a loved one and wanted to imprint his image in her mind. She rubbed her lips against each other and finally got out the words.
I am a vampire.
The corners of Laka's mouth wanted to pull up into a silly grin, his mouth say something soothing, perhaps funny. But the corners of his mouth didn't move, and the comment took a wrong turn somewhere, never got anywhere near his lips. Instead, all he got out was,
"No."
He massaged his neck to change the atmosphere, to break the stillness that made all words the truth. Virginia spoke in a low voice, controlled.
"I went to Eustace to kill him. If it hadn't happened, what happened, I would have killed him, and then drunk his blood. I would have done that. It was my intention, with it all. Do you understand?"
Laka's gaze wandered over the walls of the room, as if it were searching for the mosquito, the source of the insufferable buzzing sound that in the silence was tickling his brain, making it impossible to think. It finally stopped at one of the overhead lights.
"That damned sound."
Virginia looked up at the light.
"I can't stand light. I can't eat. I have horrible thoughts. I'm going to hurt people. You. I don't want to live."
Finally, something more concrete, something he could respond to.
"You can't say things like that," Laka said.
"Ginger, you are not allowed to talk like that.
You hear? Do you?"
"You don't understand."
"No, I probably don't. But you are not going to die, damn it. Here you are, you're talking, you are... It's okay."
Laka got up out of the chair, took a few aimless steps over the floor, held his arm out.
"You're not allowed to... You're not allowed to say those things."
"Laka.
Laka..." "Yes."
"You know that it's true, don't you?"
"What?"
"What I'm talking about."
Laka snorted, shook his head while his hands patted his chest, his pockets. "Need a smoke. That..." He found the crumpled cigarette packet, the lighter, managed to get out the last cigarette, put it into his mouth. Then he remembered where he was, took the cigarette out.
"Damn! They'll have me out of my behind if I..."
"Open the window."
"Now you're telling me to jump too?"
Virginia smiled. Laka walked over to the window, opened it all the way, and leaned out as far as he could. The nurse he had talked to could probably catch the whiff of a cigarette a mile away. He lit the cigarette and inhaled deeply, making an effort to exhale the smoke so it didn't blow back in the window. Looked up at the stars. Behind him, Virginia started to talk again.
"It was that child. I've been infected. And then it has grown. I know where it's centered. In my heart. The whole heart. Like cancer. I can't control it."
Laka blew out a column of smoke. His voice echoed between the tall buildings around them.
"Nonsense. You seem normal."
"I'm making an effort, and they've given me blood. But if I let go, at any moment I could let go, and then it would take over. I know it. I feel it.
Virginia took a few deep breaths, continued.
You are standing there. I'm looking at you, and I want to eat you.
Lacquer didn't know if it was the kink in his neck or something else that sent a shiver down his spine. He suddenly felt vulnerable. He quickly stubbed out the cigarette against the wall, flicked the butt away in an arc, turned back into the room.
This is complete, utter insanity.
Yes, but that's how it is.
Lacquer crossed his arms across his chest. With a forced laugh, he asked,
What do you want me to do?
I want you to destroy my heart.
What? How?
However you want.
Lacquer rolled his eyes.
Can you hear yourself? How this sounds? It's crazy. Like I should drive a stake into you or something.
Yes.
No, no, no. You can forget about it in that case. Have to think of something better.
Lacquer laughed, shaking his head. Virginia looked at him as he walked to and fro across the room, with his arms still folded across his chest. Then she nodded gently.
Okay.
He walked over to her, took her hand. It felt unnatural that it was restrained. He didn't even have enough room to put both his hands around it. But her hand was the warm one, squeezed his. With his free hand, he stroked her cheek.
Are you sure I shouldn't undo these things?
No, it can come back.
You're going to get well. It'll work out. I only have you. Do you want to know a secret?
Without letting go of her hand, he sat down in the armchair and started to tell her. Told her everything. About the stamps, the lion, Norway, the money, the little cottage they were going to buy. Red Falu paint. Spun out a long fantasy about what the garden was going to look like, what flowers they would have, and how you could put out a small table, make a little shady patio where you could sit. Somewhere in all of this, the tears started to flow from Virginia's eyes. Quiet, translucent pearls that found their way down her cheeks wet her pillowcase. No sobs, just tears that streamed down, jewels of sadness or joy. Lacquer grew silent. Virginia squeezed his hand hard. Then Lacquer walked out into the corridor and managed to half-convince, half-plead his way to an extra cot. He positioned it so it was exactly next to Virginia's, turned out the light, took off his clothes, and crawled down into the stiff sheets, fumbled for and found her hand. They lay like that for a long time. Then came the words,
Lacquer, I love you.
And Lacquer did not reply, simply let the words hang in the air, become encapsulated and grow until they were a large red blanket that floated around the room, that lowered itself onto him and kept him warm all night. ...4:23, Monday morning, Iceland Square. A number of people in the vicinity of Bjornsonsgaden are awakened by loud screams. One person, who calls the police, believes it is an infant crying. When the police arrive on the scene 10 minutes later, the screams have stopped. They search the area and find a number of dead cats. On some, limbs have been separated from the body. The police find contact information on the cats with collars and make a note of names and telephone numbers with the intention of notifying the owners. Street services are contacted for clean-up. Half an hour until sunrise. Ile is reclining in the armchair in the living room. He has been there all night, morning, packed up what there is to pack. Tomorrow evening, as soon as it gets dark, Ile will go to a telephone booth and ring a taxi. He doesn't know which number to call, but it's probably something that everybody knows. Just have to ask. When the taxi comes, he'll load his 3 boxes into the trunk and ask the taxi driver to take him... where? Ile shuts his eyes, tries to imagine a place he would like to be. As usual, the first image he sees is of the cottage where he lived with his parents, his older siblings. But it is gone. Outside Nurshirping, where it once stood, there is now a roundabout. The stream where his mother rinsed their clothes has dried up, become overgrown, a depression next to the intersection. Elay has a lot of money, would be able to ask the taxi driver to take him anywhere, as far as the darkness allows. North, south, could sit in the back seat and ask the driver to drive north for 2,000 kroner, then get out, start over, find someone who... Elay throws his head back, screams up at the ceiling, "I don't want to!" The dusty cobweb sways slightly in his exhalation. The sound dies in this sealed room. Elay puts his hands to his face, presses his fingers against his eyelids, feels it in his body, the approaching sunrise, like a worry. He whispers, "God, God, why can't I have anything? Why can't I?" It has been brought up many times before, this question. Why can't I be allowed to live? Because you should be dead. Only once after he had been infected did Elay meet another infected person, a grown woman, just as cynical and hollow as the man with the wig. But Elay received an answer to another question that had been nagging him. "Are there many of us?" The woman shook her head and had said with theatrical sadness, "No, we are so few, so few." "Why?" "Why? Because most of us kill ourselves, that's why. You must understand that. Such a heavy burden. Oh, my." Her hands fluttered. She said in a shrill voice, "Oh, I cannot bear to have dead people on my conscience." "Can we die?" "Of course we can. All you have to do is set fire to yourself, or let other people do it. They're only too happy to oblige, have done so through the ages. Or," she held out her index finger and pressed it hard into Elay's chest above the heart, "there, that's where it is, isn't it? But now, my friend, I have a wonderful idea." And Elay had fled from that wonderful idea, as before, as later. Elay put his hand on his heart, felt the slow beats. Maybe it was because he was a child. Maybe that was why he hadn't put an end to it. The pangs of conscience were weaker than his will to live. Elay got up out of the armchair. Hawken would not turn up tonight. But before Elay went to rest, he had to check on Tommy, that he had recovered. He had not become infected, but for Oscar's sake, Elay wanted to make sure that Tommy was fine. He turned off all the lights and left the apartment. Down in Tommy's stairwell, all he had to do was pull the cellar door open. A long time ago, when he was down here with Oscar, he had tucked some paper into the lock so it would stay unlatched when the door closed. He stepped into the cellar corridor and let the door fall shut behind him with a muted thud. He stopped, listened. Nothing. No sound of a sleeping person's breathing. Only the cloying smell of paint thinners, glue. He walked quickly along the corridor to the storage area, pulled open the door. Empty. 20 minutes until sunrise. During the night, Tommy had glided in and out of a daze of sleep, half-wakefulness, nightmares. He didn't know how much time had gone by when he started to wake up properly. The naked bulb in the cellar was always the same. Maybe it was dawn, morning, day. Maybe school had already started. He didn't care. His mouth tasted of glue. He looked around, bleary-eyed. There were 2 banknotes on his chest, 1,000 kroner notes. He bent his arm to pick them up, felt a tugging on his skin. A large band-aid was pasted over the inside of his elbow, a small bloodstain in the middle of the patch. But there was something more. He turned on the couch, searching along the inside of the cushions, and found the roll he had dropped during the night. 3,000 more. He unfolded the bills, put them together with the bills from his chest, felt the whole lot, made them crinkle. 5,000. Anything he wanted to do. He looked at the Band-Aid, chuckled. Not bad for just lying back and closing your eyes. Not bad for just lying back and closing your eyes. What was that? Someone had said it. Someone. That was it. Toba's sister. What was her name? Ingela. Turning tricks, Toba had told him. And she got 500 for it. And Toba's comment was, not bad for just lying back and closing your eyes. Tommy squeezed the bills in his hand, scrunched them up into a ball. She had paid for and drunk his blood. An illness, she had said. But what kind of fucking illness was that? He had never heard of anything like it. And if you had something like that, you went to the hospital. Then they gave you... You didn't fucking go down into some basement with 5,000 and... Swish. No. Tommy sat up on the couch, pulled off the blanket. They didn't exist. No, not vampires. That girl, the one in the yellow dress, she must somehow believe that she is... But wait. Wait. It was that ritual killer that... the one they were searching for. Tommy leaned his head in his hands, the bills crinkled against his ear. He couldn't figure it out. But in any case, he was damn scared of that girl now. Just as he was thinking about going back up to the apartment, even if it was still night, come what may, he heard the door to his stairwell open. His heart fluttered like a frightened bird, and he looked around. Weapon. The only thing he could see was the broom. Tommy's mouth was pulled up into a smile that lasted for a second. The broom. A good weapon against vampires. Then he remembered, got up and walked to the safety room while he stuffed the money into his pocket, cleared the corridor in one step and slid into the safety room as the cellar door opened. Didn't dare lock the door since he was afraid she would hear it. He sank into a crouch in the dark, tried to breathe as silently as possible. The razor blade glimmered on the floor. One corner was stained with brown like rust. Elay tore off a corner of the cover of a motorcycle magazine, wrapped the paper around the razor blade, put it into his pocket. Tommy was gone. That meant he was alive. He had left on his own, gone home to sleep. And even if he put two and two together, he didn't know where Elay lived, so... Everything is as it should be. Everything is... great. There was a wooden broom with a long handle leaning against the wall. Elay took it, broke it over his knee, almost as far down as the head of the broom. The surface of the break was rough, sharp, a thin stake, about an arm's length. He put the point against his chest, between two ribs, exactly where the woman had put her finger. He took a deep breath, squeezed the shaft, and tried on the thought. In. In. Breathed out, loosened his grip. Squeezed again, pressed. For 2 minutes he stood with the point 1 centimetre from his heart, the shaft held firmly in his hand, when the handle of the cellar door was slammed down and the door glided open. He removed the wooden stake from his chest, listened, heard slow, tentative steps in the corridor, like from a child who had just learned to walk, a very large child who had just learned to walk. Tommy heard the steps and thought, who? Not Stefan, not Lasse, not Robin. Someone who was sick in some way, who was carrying something very heavy. Santa Claus. His hand went up to his mouth to smother a giggle as he imagined Santa Claus, the Disney version,
ho, 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 say, mama,
comes staggering through the corridor with his enormous bag on his back. His lips trembled under his hand, and he clenched his teeth to stop them from chattering. Still in a crouch, he shuffled back from the door one step at a time, felt the corner of the room at his back at the same time as the spear of light from the door was darkened. Santa Claus had stopped between the light and the shelter. Tommy put his other hand over the first to stop himself from screaming, waited for the door to open. Nowhere to run to. Through cracks in the door, he could see a fragmented outline of Hawkins' body. Elay stretched the stake out as far as it went, nudged the door. It swung out about 10 centimetres, then the body outside stopped it. One hand grabbed the edge of the door, threw it open so it banged into the wall, tearing off one of the hinges. The door sagged, swung back, leaning on its remaining hinge, hitting against the shoulder of the body that now filled the door opening. "What do you want from me?" There were still patches of blue on the shirt that covered the body to the knees. The rest was a dirty map of earth, mud, stains of something Elay's nose identified as animal blood, human blood. The shirt was torn in several places, revealing white skin, etched with scratches that would never heal. His face had not changed. It was still a clumsily fashioned mass of naked flesh, with one single red eye thrown in, as if for fun, a ripe cherry to top a rotten cake. But his mouth was open now. A black hole in the lower half of the face. No lips to cover the teeth that were revealed, an uneven semicircle of white that made the oral cavity seem even darker. The hole increased and decreased in size with a chewing motion, and out of it came... You couldn't hear if the sound was supposed to mean hi, hey, or Elay, since the L had to be formed without the help of lips or tongue. Elay pointed the stake at Hawkins' heart, said, "Hi. What do you want?" The undead. Elay knew nothing about them, didn't know if the creature in front of him was limited by the same restrictions as he was, if it even helped to destroy the heart. That Hawken was standing still in the doorway seemed to imply one thing, that he needed an invitation. Hawken's gaze ran up and then down over Elay's body, which felt unprotected in the thin yellow dress. He wished there was more to the fabric, more protection between his body and Hawken. Tentatively, Elay held the stake closer to Hawken's chest. Can he feel anything? Can he even feel fear now? Elay experienced a feeling that he had almost forgotten. Fear of pain. Everything healed, of course, but there was such an overpowering sense of threat emanating from Hawken that... "What do you want?" A hollow, rasping sound as the creature pressed out air and a drop of yellowish, viscous liquid ran out of the double hole where the nose had been. A sigh, then a damaged whisper. And one arm flinched quickly, cramp-like, baby movements, clumsily grabbed the shirt down at the hem, pulled it up. Hawkins' penis stood out from his body to one side, craving attention, and Elay looked at its stiff swollenness crisscrossed with veins and... How can he... He must have had it the whole time. Hawkins' hand pulled the foreskin aggressively up and back, and the head of his penis appeared and disappeared like a jack-in-the-box, while he uttered a sound of pleasure or suffering. And Elay laughed with relief. All this to be able to jack off. He could stand there, rooted to the spot until... Can he even get it off? He's going to have to stand there forever. Elay imagined one of those obscene dolls that you wound up with a key, a monk whose cape went up and he started masturbating as long as the mechanism allowed. Clickety-click, clickety-click. Elay laughed, was so occupied with the crazy image that he didn't notice when Hawkins stepped into the room uninvited. Didn't notice anything until the fist that had just been sealed around an impossible pleasure was raised above his head. With a flashing spasm, the arm came down and the fist landed over Elay's ear with a force that could have killed a horse. The blow came sideways, and Elay's ear was folded in with such force that the skin split, and half the ear was separated from his head, which met the cement floor with a muffled crack. When Tommy realized that the thing that was out in the corridor was not on its way to the shelter, he dared to take his hand from his mouth. He sat pressed into the corner and listened, trying to understand. The girl's voice.
Hi, what do you want?
Then her laugh, and then that other voice. Didn't even sound like it came from a human being. Then muffled thuds, the sounds of bodies moving. Now there was some kind of rearranging going on out there. Something was dragged across the floor, and Tommy was not planning to find out what it was. But the sounds disguised those he could make as he stood up and felt his way along the wall to the stacked boxes. His heart was smattering like a toy drum, and his hands shook. He didn't dare flick his lighter, so to concentrate better he shut his eyes and searched with his hand over the top of the boxes. His fingers clenched around what they found. Staffan's shooting trophy. He carefully lifted it from its place, tested it in his hand. If he held the figure's chest, the stone base made a kind of club. He opened his eyes, found that he could vaguely make out the outline of the little silver pistol shooter.
Friend, my little friend.
With the trophy pressed against his chest, he sank down into the corner again, and waited for all this to be over. Elay was being handled like an object. While he was swimming to the surface of the darkness he had sunk into, he felt how his body, at a distance, in another part of the sea, was being handled. Intense pressure against his back, legs that were forced up, back, and iron rings pulled tight around his ankles. Now the ankles with their iron rings were on either side of his head, and his spine was tight, so stretched it felt like it was about to snap. I'm going to break. His head felt like a container of gleaming pain, as his body was doubled over by force, folded up like a bale of fabric. And Elay thought he was still having an hallucination, because when his eyes started to see again, they only saw yellow. And behind the yellow, a massive billowing shadow. Then came the cold. Something was rubbing a ball of ice across the thin skin between his buttocks. Something tried, first poking, then thrusting, to force its way into him. Elay gasped. The fabric of the dress that had been spread over his face was blown aside, and he saw. Hawken was lying over him. His only eye was staring fixedly at Elay's spread buttocks. His hands were locked around Elay's ankles, whose legs had been brutally bent back so that his knees were pressed to the ground on either side of his shoulders. When Hawken pressed harder, Elay heard how the tendons in the back of his own thighs broke like tightly pulled strings.
No!
Elay screamed into Hawken's shapeless face, where no feelings at all could be discerned. A strand of drool came out of Hawken's mouth, stretched and broke, falling onto Elay's lips, and the taste of corpse filled his mouth. Elay's arms fell out from his body as limp as a rag doll's. Something under his fingers, round, hard. He tried to think, forced himself to create a sphere of light inside the black, whirling insanity, and envisioned himself in the pool of light, holding the stick in his hand. Yes. Elay squeezed the handle of the broom, locking his fingers around the delicate saviour, while Hawken kept pushing, poking, trying to enter. The point has to be on the right side. He turned his head to the stick and saw it was lying the right way. A chance. Everything went quiet inside Elay's head as he visualized what he had to do. Then he did it. In one movement, he raised the stick from its prone position and thrust it up towards Hawken's face with all his might. His underarm brushed against the side of his thigh, and the stick formed a straight line that stopped a few centimetres from Hawken's face when Elay, because of his position, could not manage to move his arm any further. He had failed. For 1 second, Elay had time to think that maybe he possessed the ability to will his body to die, if he turned off all. Then Hawken thrust himself forward and at the same time dropped his head down. With the soft sound of a wooden spoon pushed down into thick porridge, the sharp end of the stick went into his eye. Hawken did not scream. Perhaps he did not even feel it. Maybe it was simply surprise at not being able to see that made him loosen his grip around Ile's ankles. Without feeling anything from his damaged legs, Ile wriggled his feet free and kicked straight out at Hawken's chest. The soles of his feet met skin with a moist smacking sound, and Hawken fell back. Ile pulled his legs under him, and with a wave of cold pain from his back, he got to his knees. Hawken had not fallen, only been folded up, and like an electric doll in a ghost house, he now straightened up again. They faced each other on their knees. The stick in Hawken's eye was pulled downward in stages, inching down with the regularity of a second hand, and then fell out, drummed out a few beats on the floor, and then it lay still. A translucent fluid started to seep out of the hole where it had been, a teary flood. Neither of them moved. The fluid from Hawken's eye trickled down onto his naked thighs. Ile concentrated all of his strength into his right arm, made a fist. When Hawken's shoulder jerked to life and his body made an effort to stretch out to Ile to pick up where it had left off, Ile hit his right hand straight into the left side of Hawken's chest. The ribs cracked and the skin was stretched to its limit for a moment, then gave way, broke. Hawken's head bent down to see what it couldn't see as Ile fumbled inside his chest cavity and found his heart. A cold, soft lump, unmoving. It's not alive, but it has to. Ile squeezed the heart until it went to pieces. It gave way too easily, allowed itself to be broken like a dead jellyfish. Hawken only reacted as if a particularly persistent fly had settled on his skin. He moved his arm up to remove the irritating element, and before he had time to grip Ile's wrist, Ile pulled his hand out with the remnants of the heart quivering in the clenched fist. Have to get away from here. Ile wanted to get up, but his legs would not obey him. Hawken was groping blindly, arms out in front, trying to find him. Ile rolled over on his stomach and started to crawl out of the room, his knees whispering on the concrete. Hawken turned his head towards the noise, put his arms out, and got a hold of the dress, managed to tear off one sleeve before Ile reached the door, got up on his knees again. Hawken stood up. Ile had a few seconds of reprieve before Hawken found the door. He tried to order his broken joints to heal enough to enable him to stand, but by the time Hawken reached the door, Ile's legs were only strong enough to allow him to stand braced against the wall. Splinters from the rough planks punctured the tops of his fingers as his hands scratched along them in order not to fall. And he knew now that without a heart, blind Hawken would pursue him until... Must destroy him. A black line. A vertical black line in front of his eyes. It had not been there before. Ile knew what to do. Hawken's hand around one edge of the doorframe, and then the body that came staggering out of the storage unit, hands groping the air in front of him. Ile pressed his back into the wall, waiting for the right moment. Hawken came out, a few tentative steps, then stopped exactly in front of Ile. Listened. Sniffed. Ile leaned forward so that his hands were the same height as Hawken's shoulders. Then he braced himself against the wall, rushed forward, and put everything into throwing Hawken off balance. He succeeded. Hawken took a mincing step to the side and fell against the door to the shelter. The crack in the door, that Ile had seen as a black line, widened as the door opened inwards and Hawken tumbled into the darkness. Ile started to fall headlong into the corridor, managed to stop himself before the floor met his face, then crawled to the door and grabbed the lower of the two locking wheels. Hawken lay still on the floor inside as Ile pulled the door shut and turned the wheel, locked it. Then he crawled out to the cellar office, got the stick, and threaded it in between the locking wheels so that it could not be unlocked from the inside. Ile continued to concentrate his energy on healing his body and started to crawl out of the basement. A rivulet of blood snaked out of his ear. At the door out of the cellar, he was healed enough to stand up. He pushed the door open and managed to go up the stairs on wobbly legs. Rest, rest, rest. He pushed open the door at the top of the stairs and stepped out into the hall. He was beaten, humiliated, and the sunrise threatened just under the horizon. Rest, rest, rest. But he had to exterminate. And there was only one way he knew to do that. Fire. Staggering, he made his way across the yard, heading to the only place he knew where he could find it. 7:34, Monday morning, Blackberry. The burglar alarm at the ICA grocery store on Arvid Murnis's way is set off. The police arrive at the scene 11 minutes later and find the store window broken. The store owner, who lives next door, is there. He says that from his window he saw a very young, dark-haired person leave the place running, but upon searching the store, nothing is found to be stolen. 7:36, sunrise. The hospital blinds were much better, darker, than her own. There was only one place where the blinds were damaged, where they let in a thin ray of morning light that made a dust-grey slash in the dark ceiling. Virginia lay outstretched, stiff in her bed, staring at the grey slice of light that trembled when a gust of wind made the window vibrate. Reflected, weak light. No more than a mild irritation, a grain of sleep in her eye. Lacquer snuffled and wheezed in the bed next to her. They had stayed awake for a long time, talking. Memories, mostly. Close to 4 in the morning, Lacquer had finally fallen asleep, with his hand still in hers. She had had to disentangle her hand from his an hour later, when a nurse had come in to check her blood pressure, found it satisfactory, and left them with a glance, actually a tender look at Lacquer. Virginia had heard how Lacquer pleaded to stay, the reasons he had given. Thus the tender glance, she supposed. Now Virginia lay with her hands folded on her chest, fighting her body's desire to turn off. Fall asleep was not an adequate expression for it. As soon as she did not consciously concentrate on her breathing, it stopped. But she needed to stay awake. She hoped a nurse would come back in before Lacquer woke up. Yes, the very best thing would be if he could sleep until it was over. But that was probably too much to hope for. The sun caught up with Elay in the courtyard, a glowing tong that pinched his mauled ear. Instinctively, he backed up into the shade of the entrance to the yard, squeezed the 3 plastic bottles of tea red to his chest, as if to shield them from the sun as well. 10 steps away was his front door, 20 steps to Oscar's, and 30 steps to Tommy's. I can't do it. No. If he had been healthy, strong, he would have tried to make it to Oscar's entrance, through the flood of light that intensified every second he waited. But not to Tommy's, and not now. 10 steps, then up the stairs, the big window in the stairwell. If I trip, if the sun... Elay ran. The sun threw itself over him like a hungry lion, biting into his back. Elay almost lost his balance as he was thrown forward by the sun's howling force. Nature vomited its disgust at his transgression. To show himself in sunlight for even 1 second. It sizzled, bubbled, like someone pouring boiling oil on Elay's back when he reached the front door, threw it open. The pain almost made him faint, and he moved towards the steps as if drugged, blinded, didn't dare open his eyes for fear that they would melt. He dropped one of the bottles, heard it roll away across the floor. Couldn't be helped. With head bent, one arm wrapped around the remaining bottles, the other on the banister, he limped up the stairs, reached the landing. 1 flight left. Through the window, the sun delivered a last swipe at his neck, snapped at him, then bit him in the thighs, calves, heels, while he moved up the stairs. He was burning. The only thing missing was flames. He got the door open, fell into the wonderful, cool darkness inside, slammed the door shut behind him. But it was not dark. The kitchen door was open, and in the kitchen there were no blinds in front of the window. The light was weaker, greyer than what he had just experienced, and without hesitation, Elay dropped the bottles onto the floor, continued on. While the light clawed relatively tenderly at his back as he crawled to the bathroom, the smell of burnt flesh wafted into his nose. "I will never be whole again." He stretched his arm out, opened the bathroom door, and crawled into the compact darkness. He pushed a couple of plastic jugs out of the way, closed the door, and locked it. Before he slid into the bathtub, he had time to think, "I didn't lock the front door." But it was too late. Rest turned him off at the same moment as he sank down into the wet darkness. He wouldn't have had the energy anyway. Tommy sat still, pressed into the corner. He held his breath until his ears started to ring and he saw shooting stars in front of his eyes. When he heard the cellar door slam shut, he dared to let his breath out in a long, panting exhalation that rolled along the cement walls, died out. It was completely quiet. The darkness was so complete that it had mass, weight. He held one hand in front of his face. Nothing. No difference. He touched his face as if to convince himself that he existed at all. Yes, his fingertips touched his nose, his lips. Unreal. They flickered to life under his fingers, disappeared. The little figurine in his other hand felt more alive, more real than he did. He squeezed it, held it close. Tommy had been sitting with his head bent down between his knees, his eyes tightly shut, his hands held against his ears, in order not to have to know, not to hear, what was going on in the storage unit. It sounded like that little girl was being murdered. He would not have been able to do anything, not dared do anything, and therefore he had tried to deny the whole situation by disappearing. He had been with his dad, on the soccer field, in the forest, at the Carnan Baths. Finally, he had paused at the memory of that time on the Rockstar field, when he and his dad had tried a remote-control aeroplane that his dad had borrowed from someone at work. Mum had come along for a while, but she thought it was boring to look at the aeroplane making circles in the sky, and had gone home. He and his dad had kept going until it got dark, and the aeroplane was a silhouette against the pink evening sky. Then they had walked home, hand in hand, through the forest. Tommy had been in that day, far from the screams, the insanity going on a few meters away. He was only aware of the furious buzz of the aeroplane, the warmth of his father's large hand on his back while he nervously maneuvered the plane in wide circles over the field, the graveyard. Back then, Tommy had never been in the graveyard, had imagined people walking aimlessly around the graves, crying large, shiny comic book tears that splashed against the headstones. That was then. Then Dad had died, and Tommy had learned that graveyards rarely, all too rarely, look like that. His hands tightly pressed against his ears, and away with those thoughts. Think about walking through the forest. Think about the smell of the aeroplane's special gas in the little bottle. Think about... Only when he, halfway through his soundproofing, heard a lock being turned, had he taken his hands down and looked. To no avail, since the safety room was even blacker than the darkness behind his eyelids. Started to hold his breath when the second wheel thundered into place, kept holding it as whatever it was still in the basement. Then that distant bang from the door to the stairwell, a vibration in the walls, and here he was, still alive. It didn't get me. Exactly what it was, he didn't know. But whatever it was, it had not discovered him. Tommy got up from his crouched position. A tingling trail of ants ran through his numb leg muscles as he groped along the wall towards the door. His hands were sweaty with fear, and with the pressure against his ears, the statuette almost slid out of his hand. His free hand found the wheel of the closing mechanism and started to turn it. It went about 10 centimeters, then it stopped. What is this? He pressed harder, but the wheel wouldn't budge. He dropped the statuette in order to be able to grab the wheel with both hands, and it fell to the floor with a thud. He froze. That sounded funny, as if it landed on something soft. He crouched down next to the door, tried to turn the lower wheel. Same thing, 10 centimeters, then stop. He sat down on the floor, tried to think practically. Damn, am I going to be stuck here? Like that, sort of. But it still came creeping, this terror he had had a few months after his dad died. He had not felt it for a long time, but now, locked in the pitch blackness, it was starting to make itself known again. Love for his dad that through death had been transformed into a fear of him, of his body. A lump started to grow in his throat, his fingers stiffened. Think now, think! There were candles on a shelf in the storage room on the other side. The problem was making his way over there in the dark. Idiot! He slapped his forehead, laughed out loud. He had a lighter. And anyway, what was the use of looking for those candles if there wasn't anything to light them with? Like that guy with thousands of cans and no can opener, starved to death surrounded by food. While he dug around in his pocket for his lighter, he reflected that his situation wasn't so hopeless. Sooner or later, someone would come down into the basement, his mum, if no one else, and if he could just get some light in here, that would be something. He got the lighter out of his pocket, lit it. His eyes, that had grown used to the dark, were momentarily blinded by the light, but then, when they adjusted, he saw that he was not alone. Outstretched on the floor, right next to his feet, was Dad. The fact that his father had been cremated did not register with him as he, in the fluttering flame of the lighter, saw the face of the corpse. It met his expectations of how one would look after having been in the earth for many years. Dad. He screamed straight into the lighter, so the flame went out, but the split second before the light went out, he had time to see his dad's head jerk and... It's alive! The contents of his bowels spilled into his pants in a wet explosion that splattered warmth over his rear end. Then his legs crumpled up, his skeleton dissolved, and he fell into a heap, dropped the lighter so it bounced across the floor. His hand landed straight on the corpse's cold toes. Sharp nails scratched the palm of his hand, and while he continued to shriek, "But, Dad, haven't you trimmed your toenails?" he started to pat, to stroke the cold foot, as if it were a frozen puppy that needed comforting. Kept petting up the shin bone, the thigh, felt the muscles tense under the skin, move while he screamed in fits and starts like an animal. The tips of his fingers felt metal. The statuette. It lay nestled between the thighs of the corpse. He grabbed the figurine by the chest, stopped screaming, and returned for a moment to the practical. A club. In the silence after his scream, he heard a dripping, sticky sound when the corpse raised its upper body, and when a cold limb nudged the back of his hand, he pulled it back, squeezing the statuette. "It is not Dad." No. Tommy drew back, away from the corpse, with excrement clinging to his buttocks, and thought for a moment that he could see in the dark, as his sound impressions transformed into vision, and he saw the corpse rise up in the darkness, a yellowish shape, a constellation. With his feet tap-dancing over the floor, he shuffled backwards to the wall. The corpse on the other side uttered a short exhalation. And Tommy saw a little elephant, an animated elephant, and here comes Toot, the big elephant, and then Trunks up, and Toot A, and then Magnus, Brassa, and Ava enter and sing, There is here, where you are not. Now how did it go? The corpse must have bumped into the stack of boxes because he could hear thuds, the rattle of stereo equipment that fell to the floor as Tommy pressed up against the wall, hitting the back of his head and seeing a kind of static. Through the roar, he could hear the smack of stiff, bare feet walking across the floor, searching. Here is there where you are not. No, yes. Just like that. He wasn't here. He couldn't see himself, couldn't see the thing that was making the noise. So it was only sound. It was just something he was listening to as he stared into the black mesh of the speaker. This was something that didn't even exist. Here is there where you are not. He almost started to sing out loud, but a sensible remnant of his consciousness told him not to. The white buzz started to die down, leaving an empty surface where he started to stack new thoughts with effort. The face. The face. He didn't want to think about its face, did not want to think about something about the face that had been momentarily illuminated by the lighter. It was getting closer. Not only did the footsteps sound closer, now hissing across the floor. No. He could feel its presence like a shadow more impenetrable than the darkness. He bit down on his lower lip until he tasted blood, shut his eyes, saw his own two eyes disappear out of the picture like two eyes. He doesn't have eyes. A faint breeze on his face as a hand went through the air. Blind. It is blind. He wasn't sure, but the lump on the creature's shoulders had not had any eyes. When the hand went through the air again, Tommy felt the caress of air on his cheek 1/10 of a second before it reached him, had time to turn his face so the hand only brushed against his hair. He finished the movement and threw himself flat on the floor, started to snake along the floor with his hands circling in front of him, swimming. The lighter! The lighter! Something poked into his cheek, a wave of nausea when he realized it was the thing's toenail, but he quickly rolled over so he wouldn't be in the same place when the hands came groping for him. Here is there where I am not. An involuntary chuckle issued from his mouth. He tried to stop it, but couldn't. Saliva sprayed out of his mouth, and out of his hoarse from screaming throat came hiccups of laughter or crying, while his hands, two radar beams, continued searching the floor for the only advantage he maybe, maybe, had over the darkness that wanted to devour him. God help me. Let the light of thy face. God, sorry about that thing in church. Sorry about everything. God, I will always believe in you, however you want, if you just let me find the lighter. Be my friend, please, God. Something happened. At the same moment that Tommy felt the thing's hand flailing across his foot, for a split second, the room was illuminated with blue-white light, like from a flash. And during that split second, Tommy really did see the boxes that had tumbled to the floor, the uneven surface of the walls, the passageway into the storage rooms. And he saw the lighter. It was only a meter from his right hand, and when the darkness engulfed him again, the location of the lighter was burned onto the inside of his eyelid. He yanked his foot from the thing's grip, flung his arm out, and managed to grab the lighter, held it firmly in his hand, jumped up onto his feet. Without thinking about whether it was too much to ask, he started to chant a new prayer inside his head. Let the thing be blind, God. Let it be blind, God. Let it be blind. He flicked the lighter. A flash like the one he had just experienced, then a yellow flame with a blue center. The thing stood still, turned its head towards the sound, started to walk in that direction. The flame flickered when Tommy slid two steps to the side and arrived at the door. The thing stopped where Tommy had been 3 seconds earlier. If he had been able to feel joy, he would have. But in the weak light from the lighter, everything suddenly became mercilessly real. It was no longer possible to escape into some fantasy that he was really not here at all, that this wasn't happening to him. He was locked into a soundproofed room with the thing he was most afraid of. Something turned in his stomach, but there was nothing more to be emptied. All that came was a little fart, and the thing turned its head again, towards him. Tommy pulled at the wheel of the locking mechanism with his free hand so that the hand holding the lighter trembled and the flame went out. The wheel didn't budge, but out of the corner of his eye, Tommy had time enough to see how the thing was coming towards him, and he threw himself away from the door in the direction of the wall where he had been sitting before. He sobbed, snuffled, "Let this end! God, let it end!" Again the big elephant, who raised his hat and with his nasal voice said, "This is the end! Blow the trumpet, trunk! Toot! This is the end!"
"I'm going crazy.
He shook his head, flicked the lighter on again. There on the floor in front of him was the trophy. He bent over, picked it up, and jumped a few steps to the side, kept going towards the other wall, looked at the thing groping the space where he had just been.
Blind man's bluff.
The lighter in one hand, the trophy in the other. He opened his mouth to say something, but only managed a hoarse whisper.
"Come on, then."
The thing appeared alert, turned around, came towards him. He raised Staffan's trophy like a club, and when the creature was half a meter away, he swung it at its face. And like in a perfect penalty kick in soccer, when at the same moment as your foot meets the ball, you feel that this one has hit the spot exactly. Tommy felt the same thing already halfway into his swing that, yes. And when the sharp stone corner met the thing's temple with a force that continued in an arc along Tommy's arm, he was already feeling triumph. It was only a confirmation of this feeling when the skull crumpled and with a crack of splitting ice, cold liquid splashed onto Tommy's face and the thing crashed to the ground. Tommy remained in place, panting, looked at the body that was laid out on the ground. He has an erection. Yes, the thing's penis was sticking out like a minimal, half-overturned gravestone, and Tommy stood there staring, waiting for it to wilt. It didn't. Tommy wanted to laugh, but his throat hurt too much. A throbbing pain in his thumb. Tommy looked down. The lighter had started to burn the skin on his thumb that was holding the gas tab down. Instinctively, he let go. But his thumb didn't obey him. It was locked in a cramp over the tab. He turned the lighter the other direction. Didn't want to turn it off anyway. Didn't want to be left in the dark with this... A movement. And Tommy felt how something important, something he needed in order to be Tommy, left him when the creature lifted its head again and started to get up. An elephant balancing on the little thread of a spider web. The thread broke. The elephant fell through, and Tommy hit again, and again. After a while, he started to think it was fun. Monday, the 9th of November. Morgan walked through the controls, waved the monthly pass that had expired 6 months ago, while Larry dutifully stopped and pulled out a wrinkled coupon strip and said, "Engelplan." The ticket collector looked up from the book he was reading, stamped 2 coupon spaces. Morgan laughed when Larry came over to him and they started to walk down the stairs.
"What the hell do you bother to do that for?"
"What, get my ticket stamped?"
"Yeah, it's not like you're some model citizen."
"It's not that."
"What is it?"
"I'm not like you, okay?"
"But come on, the guy was just... You could have shown him a picture of the king for all he cared."
"Yes, fine. Quit talking so loud.
Think he's going to come after us or something."
Before they opened the doors down to the platform, Morgan cupped his hands into a makeshift megaphone and shouted back up to the station hall,
"Alert! Alert! Illegal riders!"
Larry slunk away, taking a few steps towards the platform. Morgan reached him and said, "You're pretty childish, you know that?"
"Absolutely. Now, run the whole thing by me again, from the top."
Larry had called Morgan the night before and given a summary of what Eustace had told him 10 minutes earlier on the phone. They had agreed to meet at the subway station early in the morning to go to the hospital. Now Larry went over it all again. Virginia, Laka, Eustace, the cats, the ambulance that Laka had climbed into with her, added a few extra details of his own, and before he was done, the subway train to the city arrived. They got on and claimed a four-seater for themselves, and Larry finished his story with, "And then it drove off with sirens going full blast." Morgan nodded, chewing on a thumbnail, looking out of the window, while the train climbed out of the tunnel, stopped at Iceland Square.
"What the hell made them go off like that?"
"You mean the cats?"
"I don't know. Something made them all crazy."
"But all of them? And at the same time?"
"You have a better suggestion?"
"No. Damn cats. Laka must be completely crushed and all."
Wasn't doing so great before, either."
"No,"
Morgan sighed.
"I feel damn sorry for the guy, actually. We should, I don't know, do something."
"What about Virginia?"
Yeah. But, you know, being injured, sick, what can you do? You have to lie there. The hard part is sitting next to the bed and... No, I don't know, but he was right. Last time, when he... What the hell did he ramble on about? Werewolves?
Vampires.
Yeah, that's not a sign that you're doing so damn great, is it?"
The train pulled into the Ingbordplan station. When the doors closed, Morgan said,
"There, now we're in the same boat."
"I think they're more lenient if you have at least 2 stamped sections."
"That's what you think, but you don't know."
"Did you see the results of the poll for the Swedish Communist Party?"
Yes, it'll straighten itself out after the election. There's a lot of people who, when they stand there with the ballot, still vote according to their conscience."
"That's what you think."
"No, I know. The day the communists are pushed out of Parliament is the day I start believing in vampires. But of course, there's always the Conservatives. Bormann and his lot, you know. Talk about bloodsuckers."
Morgan launched into one of his monologues. Larry stopped listening somewhere near Orkershov. There was a lone police officer outside the greenhouses looking up at the subway. Larry felt a brief pang of conscience when he considered his understamped ticket, but immediately suppressed the thought when he remembered why the police were there. But this police officer looked bored. Larry relaxed. The occasional word in Morgan's rambling made its way into his consciousness while they thundered on towards Sabbatsbury. 8:15, and no nurse had yet appeared. The dirt-grey strip of light on the ceiling had turned light grey, and the blinds let in enough light to make Virginia feel she was on a tanning bed. Her body was hot, throbbed, but that was all. It wouldn't get any worse. Laka lay in the bed next to her, snarling, chewing in his sleep. She was ready. If she had been able to press a button to summon a nurse, she would have done so. But her hands were bound, and she couldn't. So she